Major funding for this Public Radio International program is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support from the Colomb Foundation, the Compton Foundation, and the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Part of the reason why I believe in nonviolence is because I'm not going to go to war and kill somebody in another country that I don't know and have no problem with. I hold human beings in a really high regard, and I have respect for people.
The power of nonviolent resistance and how it can topple dictators. You're listening to Beyond War, a documentary project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. It has sometimes been dismissed as ineffectual, naive, even dangerous. But the tradition of nonviolence may have much to teach a world so habitually engulfed in the flames of war. It is a commonly repeated belief that vicious dictators and unjust governments will yield only to massive military force. But potent examples to the contrary are now so numerous that a new field of study has emerged to analyze the surprising power of tactical nonviolence. Proponents of peaceful change point to Martin Luther King, whose patient protests caused the collapse of America's obstinate Jim Crow segregation, to the amazing youth-led movement in Yugoslavia that peacefully brought down the bloody regime of Slobodan Milosevic, and to the founder of modern nonviolence, Mohandas Gandhi, whose symbolic marches and hunger strikes drove the British Empire from India. Today, in reaction to the war in Iraq, a new peace movement is taking a fresh look at alternatives to war.
Money for schools, not for war!
One, two, three, four!
Money for schools, not for war!
Books, not bombs!
Books, not bombs!
As war clouds were gathering, prior to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in March 2003, students gathered in protest at Northeastern University in Boston. One of the activists is Jared McBride.
Under my own personal convictions, I believe that I couldn't possibly support any form of violence whatsoever, because violence is, I believe, war is an embarrassment to us as human beings. And I know the obvious criticism of that sort of statement is that it's unrealistic and we do not live in a world like that. But I believe that if more people took this stance and taught their children this stance, then we would be able to create a world like that and call it idealistic. But I think we need to start somewhere, and that starts, you know, with a personal decision.
And when you say war is an embarrassment, what do you mean?
I think war is an embarrassment as human beings. That here we are. I'm always thinking back when the Apollo went up and they're on the moon, and they look back and they seem so small, and they think, you know, why can't we just get along? And you look there and we inhabit this small space, and we're alone in this universe, and we spend an inordinate amount of time destroying and killing each other. And I think that's embarrassing to our species and to our people, that's what we do. That we can't figure things out, that we can't work things out. Being the most intelligent species on this planet, I figure that we might be able to at least, discuss things or work things out. Because we have done that in the past, too, and it seems to work a lot better than killing does. So.
Our nation enters this conflict reluctantly, yet our purpose is sure. We will meet that threat now with our Army, Air Force, Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines. Now that conflict has come, the only way to limit its duration is to apply decisive force. And I assure you, this will not be a campaign of half measures.
When U.S. President George W. Bush announced the formal decision to wage war in Iraq, it was an anguishing moment for Miranda Smith of Santa Cruz, California, a student who was working in New York City at the War Resisters League, a pacifist organization founded in World War I. She takes a philosophical view of warfare.
Well, to put it in a really simple way, I think that it's ineffective, because I think that violence begets violence. And so from that perspective, just like from a really practical perspective, I don't think that it's the most effective long-term solution to a situation. So I feel like maybe it seems like it violence can sometimes seem like it, you know, quote unquote, works at first, but in the long term, it really doesn't actually solve the problem at hand. It just creates, covers it up or complicates the situation. Or so I just feel like nonviolence is, it helps everybody, and it, and in theory, it creates solutions that are like lasting and that impact everybody. It doesn't just help like one person. Or the way that violence can sometimes just help a small amount of people, nonviolence is good for everybody.
Many people who do not view themselves as warmongers see the use of military violence as a last resort, a sad but sometimes necessary real-world evil. At the University of Florida in Gainesville, religion professor Zohara Simmons does not categorically rule out the use of force, but she regards it as a sign of colossal failure, a failure to prevent the carnage of war, and a failure to grasp the lessons of history. She was a longtime staff member at a Quaker group, the American Friends Service Committee.
The violence that is inflicted is carried through many generations, and it produces the kinds of things, you know, we see around the world, these wars that go on forever and ever, and people say, why? They've been fighting for 100 years, or they've been fighting for 200 or 300 years, why can't they stop? And, you know, those of us who are outside of those particular areas of the world are baffled. We don't understand why there can be these ethnic wars and all that go on and on. And I think it's because once blood has been shed, people have this sense that they must revenge their forebears. And so it just continues and continues. I mean, and we are witnesses to that in many places in our world today.
The devastating tragedy of war came as a horrible shock in the 1940s to a bright, adventurous teenager in Sweden, Sven Lindqvist, whose homeland had eluded the ravages of World War II. He later became a conscientious objector to military service.
Sweden was a neutral country and a sort of little island of peace where the whole world was burning in war. And nobody in my family had been outside Sweden. Nobody of my relatives, neighbors, nobody we know had ever been outside Sweden. So when I, at 15... in 1947, you know, was the first to leave Sweden. I was really ventured out into terra incognita, into an unknown country. And what I found there was, it was all bombed out.
This was right after the end of World War II.
Right after the end of World War II, Germany was just a heap of rubble. Yes, I can still remember that train sort of trying to find its way through the rubble, and children my age running beside the train crying, brot, brot, bread, bread.
What were your thoughts?
Never more war, was my thought. Nevermore.
Sven Lindqvist, now in his 70s, became a journalist, author, and playwright based in Stockholm. He has studied and frequently written about the desolation of war and its lingering effects.
An historian of the Korean War meets one of the napalm sufferers 30 years after the Korean War, and they go up in the same lift, and this is a man without a face, without hands, and he says, I was once young. I was once full of love. And I had hands that could play the piano. And now look at me. This should never happen again. This should never happen again. He had spent his entire life being operated and operated and operated on, and they had finally produced this result that was so horrific that the historian could hardly bear to look at him.
The ghastly catalogue of war's after effects begs the question of what practical alternatives to war may be available. The art of diplomacy can attain spectacular success, as in the Cuban Missile Crisis, when use of the UN and skillful negotiation averted a nuclear catastrophe. But if patient discussion fails, are there ways to thwart injustice without resorting to armed conflict? One answer lies in the technique called nonviolent conflict, as practiced by Gandhi in the early 20th century. It means invoking moral authority to mobilize the people and thus weaken the base from which tyrants derive their power.
I've experienced tremendous skepticism because people are confused about what nonviolent conflict is. They basically say, oh, you're talking about nonviolent conflict. What do you think you're going to do is convert the dictator? But nonviolent conflict is not about converting the dictator. It's about throwing him out.
From his office at a Washington investment firm near the White House, Peter Ackerman is an author and foreign policy scholar with a passion for human rights. He helped produce two major public television specials, A Force More Powerful and Bringing Down a Dictator, which chronicled the challenges and successes of nonviolent conflict.
The one thing a reign of terror does is it creates hatreds, deep, significant, widespread hatreds. So the dynamics of nonviolent resistance is to try to create ways in which people can express dissent, move away from the authoritarian, and not risk instant death. And then to get others to do the same, and that by the act of acting collectively, start to significantly reduce their risk. And that's the strategy that you have to work through.
In their moving film, A Force More Powerful, Ackerman and his team documented how a nonviolent people's movement slowly rose up in Chile in the 1980s to oppose the brutal military junta of General Augusto Pinochet, who had seized power after a violent coup in 1973. Eventually, Pinochet's regime was defeated in a national election.
Early on, the opposition wanted to have a strike in the copper mines. Learning about this, Pinochet basically put soldiers around the copper mines and basically threatened death to anyone who would express dissent in this way. So what they did is something different. One day they decided in Santiago to basically walk at half speed, drive at half speed, and then that evening to whip open their windows and start banging on pots and pans. And this is a way that everybody could signal one to the other that this regime is hated. If you can basically get rid of that terror bubble by acts of people reconnecting with each other, that could go a long way.
Whatever you impose through violence, you have to defend through violence.
Father Christian Precht of the Archdiocese of Santiago, Chile, supported the peaceful resistance to Pinochet.
That's why we think that violence is the strength of the weak, because they don't have arguments, they don't have moral authority. So whatever you achieve through violence, you have to defend through violence.
General strikes have been very important tools, for example, in the case of Solidarity, because in the case of Solidarity...
In Poland,
because the government absolutely needed the revenue from these shipyards. I mean, so they had a real economic lever to pull. Mass protests always are historically excellent methods.
The Polish trade union movement, sparked by high prices and low wages,
launched a nonviolent strike in 1980 that grew to encompass a half million workers in 370 factories. They had taken on the repressive Polish communist government, led by union activist Lech Wałęsa, who had studied the techniques of Gandhi and King. The Solidarity Movement organized workers by publishing a daily bulletin and communicating through the BBC and Radio Free Europe. The government was forced to acquiesce to the popular movement and permit the union, whose membership quickly swelled to 10 million. In another land formerly ruled by Soviet-era communism, Yugoslavia, bitter ethnic hatreds flared in the 1990s. Under the demagogic leadership of Slobodan Milosevic, the conflict led to grisly wars between the Serbs and Croats, and even to the establishment of concentration camps to carry out the genocidal policy known as ethnic cleansing. In 1999, the humanitarian disaster in Kosovo, in which nearly a million ethnic Albanians were driven from their homes, prompted a NATO-led bombing campaign against Serb forces, to which Milosevic ultimately succumbed. But according to Peter Ackerman, it was a case where military intervention may have delayed the people's expulsion of a dictator.
At the end of July of 1999, Milosevic's power was very well solidified because the population in general was very upset with the West. They felt preyed upon. They felt upset. And as in all these cases, when you're being bombed, time and time again, it's been shown that you basically wrap your wagons, if you will, around the existing leader. So his power was considerable right after the end of the bombing.
He was seen as the defender of the invading Air Force.
Right. You know, again, more of this victimization that he played so well, for a decade to such terrible results. As time goes on and memories blur a little bit and we get into the end of 1999, into the new millennium, and they had a chance to vent against the enemy, which was the Europeans and the Americans, and that sort of subsided, people refocused their disaffection on him. During that time, groups like Otpor, which was the student resistance group, and other dissident groups start to recognize that the first goal had to be to not decide who's going to rule afterwards, but to everybody need to unify around getting him out.
At the promising dawn of a new millennium, New Year's 2000, Otpor, which means resistance, staged a giant outdoor party in the Serbian capital, Belgrade. But along with the music were signs of a popular resistance movement. Plastered everywhere was their logo, the symbol of a clenched fist in a circle. And the slogan they adopted was a simple declaration against Milosevic: he's finished.
They were afraid of us, and they wanted to portray us as terrorists, as fascists, and as, I don't know, criminals, drug addicts, and something like that. But when people go out in the streets, they see members of resistance. They see that these kids are like 18 to 20 years of age. And they say, come on, this is ridiculous. These kids are not fascists. These kids are just kids.
Otpor was very clever in basically mobilizing students all around the country to leaflet, to harass the police in a friendly way, to make the police ashamed, the local police in particular, to put signs all over the country, tons and tons of paper sprawled all over every building basically saying the man's finished, he's a joke, to create humorous events that basically mocked him. Nothing like mocking somebody who's an authoritarian and getting away with it that basically starts to question people. Make people question his hold on power.
This sarcastic TV ad showed a woman at her washing machine holding up a shirt. She complained that for years she'd been trying to remove a stain from it. When she opened the shirt, it contained a photo of Milosevic.
As public opinion turned against his regime, Milosevic called an early election, hoping to catch his opposition off guard. But when the tally showed he was defeated anyway, his election commission ordered a runoff rather than acknowledge that Milosevic had been ousted by popular vote.
The whole country was mobilized in outrage because everybody knew there was enough election monitors that he had lost. It was mathematically impossible to consider the result in any other way. People were, because they had a habit of being mobilized, and there had been many events, demonstrations, and by the way, significant police repression during the spring and summer as well, that they were poised to act. In addition, there was a call for a general strike, but before that, there was a coal mine outside of Belgrade, which basically all the people went on a strike in the coal mine, the mine that was responsible for 60% or so of the electricity in the major cities in Serbia. And then what happened is that the entire country decided to invade with cars, buses, Belgrade. And every single day, more and more actions developed, put more and more pressure on the police, because to respond to all this becomes logistically very, very difficult. Communication developed between the police and people like the mayor of Čačak, one of the important cities that led some of these nonviolent invasions into Belgrade. And when the last day came, hundreds of thousands of people gathered into Belgrade, gathered around the parliament building. And it was over when it was clear the police started to walk away and they wouldn't stop anything.
From the beginning, the youthful organizers of Otpor were committed to nonviolence, repudiating the brutal tactics employed by Milosevic. The students carefully studied the history of nonviolent conflict for social change. Serge Popovic was a leader of Otpor.
Our message was, there is no war between police and us, that we together are the victims of the system. And there is no reason to have war between victims and victims. One victims are in blue uniforms, other victims are in blue jeans, but there is no reason for that blood.
Overwhelmed by popular resistance, Milosevic was forced to step down in 2000 and later was transferred to The Hague to stand trial at the UN War Crimes Tribunal. In contrast to the massive NATO bombing a year earlier, which actually bolstered the popularity of Milosevic among Serbs, the protests later mounted by students resulted in his relinquishing power with virtually no violence. Another remarkable case where injustice was overthrown using peaceful means was the consumer boycott movement in South Africa. There, the apartheid segregation system had left the majority black population degraded and disadvantaged. Unlike the violent tactics sometimes advocated by the African National Congress, ANC, a new movement in the late 1980s called on blacks to apply pressure simply by not shopping in white districts. Filmmaker Peter Ackerman.
In South Africa, in some cities, there were boycotts against shopping in white neighborhoods. And so the retail community was severely hurt financially by these economic boycotts, and it forced them, the white community, to speak to their political counterparts to start to listen to the demands of the black community. We did a story about South Africa, and we had the head of the secret police in Port Elizabeth basically say, look, the ANC's call for a violent insurrection to us was a complete joke. You know, we could fly swatted away, but these boycotts, we couldn't deal with them. They're just impossible to deal with. That's the point.
Colonel Lawrence Duplessis served in the South African secret police.
If they don't want to buy, it's not a crime if they don't want to buy from people, but it's mass action. And what do? You can't shoot all these people. You can't lock them all up. It's very effective.
Another grassroots movement opposing government-enforced segregation arose against America's form of apartheid, the Jim Crow system that prevailed in much of the southern United States. Public schools were formally segregated on racial lines. Posted signs would designate public facilities as whites-only or colored-only. In the 1950s, a generation of young activists undertook to overturn this demeaning practice.
It has definitely made a tremendous impact on my life, being one of those foot soldiers in the civil rights movement during the 60s.
In Gainesville, Zohara Simmons is professor of religion at the University of Florida.
Our movement, which was by and large a nonviolent one, was able to bring changes in systems that had existed for a long time and was able to bring those changes without leaving behind a residue, I think, of hatred that often happens when you bring about change through violence, through force.
We had a philosophy, which was a power of nonviolence. And that kind of power, we felt, was more forceful than all of their police force, all of their lawmakers, and all of their dogs or billy clubs or jails.
Bernard Lafayette was a student civil rights activist in the 60s in Nashville, Tennessee. The movement's peaceful tactics, even in the face of harassment, helped ease the way for a greater acceptance of racial equality by today's generation. Zohara Simmons.
If this had been done violently and members of their family in the past had been killed or harmed, they would be carrying that knowledge around and it would be difficult for them to accept the changes. But because it was done the way it was done, thanks to the genius of Dr. King and so many others, we can now live together in a state of peace and to some great extent harmony because of the changes brought about through a nonviolent movement for change.
You're listening to Beyond War, a documentary project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Steve Colby. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal and Kathy Graham. Music performed by Brad Hatfield. Research assistance by Erzeli Coquillon. Special thanks to York Zimmerman Incorporated, producers of A Force More Powerful and Bringing Down a Dictator, and to the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, the Einstein Institution, and the University of Florida Public Affairs Department. Our program is presented by Human Media, in association with The Network Incorporated. Program development and support provided by Chart Media.
We're distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. If you'd like to purchase a cassette copy of Humankind by phone, please call toll-free 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-L-I-S-T-E-N. To learn more about this and our other programs and to hear selected episodes online or to order tapes online, check our website, humanmedia.org. That's humanmedia.org. We'll give that again in a moment. Major funding for this program is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the Colom Foundation, the Compton Foundation, and from this station and the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Again, for tapes of Humankind, call 1-800-5-LISTEN, and our web address is humanmedia.org.
This segment of Beyond War is Humankind program number 64 from PRI, Public Radio International.